This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
In Portland and Milwaukee. Detailed information at 503-216-5380 or nwcch.com.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to broadcast the 26th annual Safeway Waterfront Blues Festival. Thursday through Sunday, July 4th through 7th, KBOO will be broadcasting live from Tom McCall Waterfront Park for the Portland metro area and throughout the state with our partners in Ashland, Bend, Newport, Salem, Warm Springs, and more. Internet listeners can tune in to KBOO.fm. Again, that's the 26th annual Waterfront Blues Festival, a benefit for the Oregon Food Bank, because no one should be hungry. More information on costs, benefit to KBOO members, performing artists, and more can be found at kboo.fm.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Stan Tamandel. Stan is a therapist and teacher who has more than 25 years' experience working with elders around forgetfulness, dementia, and extremely withdrawn states. He's the author of 3 books on coma and Alzheimer's, and he works with his wife as a consultant and teacher in Victoria, BC, as well as internationally via phone and Skype. So welcome to Madness Radio, Stan Tamandel.
Well, thanks, Will. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes. Now, this is a topic that we've done a little bit on Madness Radio, but I think it's a really something that isn't talked about enough in our society. Just the way that we treat our elders, especially the difficult states that they get into, the forgetfulness states, the dementia states. And you've been working around these topics from a very, very innovative view that basically believes in the meaning and significance of what it is that people are going through. And I'm just really inspired to have you on the show today. My dad is getting on in years, and he's facing some of these same issues, so it's also very personally significant to me. So thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned your dad, because that's how I really got deeply into this work, was through my own father, who had, not early onset, but started at about 69, going into states of forgetfulness, then died by the age of 79. And through my training and my own deep inner beliefs that someone is always home, that the essence of the person, their deep spiritual core is always there, I just knew that I could do more with my dad than was, you know, standard practice in veterans nursing home that he was in. Fantastic nursing home, by the way. When he had to go into the nursing home, and my mom kept him at home for about 2 years too long, I think that's a common story. She was burned out. He had to go into a nursing home. He went into a big depression. Who wouldn't? I certainly would. And we had to work with that depression for, 9 months before he started coming out of it. And then his dementia, his Alzheimer's, improved quite a bit after that initial depression.
By working through the depression, you actually got some of the dementia symptoms would actually change and improve.
That's right. There's a real crossover between dementia and depression. I think it's something that we tend to use too many drugs and not enough psychotherapy with. That's my personal opinion anyway. As he went further into his progression of Alzheimer's, we were always able to connect with him. And I think this is really important, that the communication is always possible, and that one of people's biggest fears when they're inside in those withdrawn states, whether it's dementia or coma, is the fear of isolation, because no one understands. We were able to work with that, and because they always connect with him and have meaningful connections with him. I went to visit one time, and for this one particular time, he was fairly withdrawn, and he had his fingers, and he was rubbing the sheet between his thumb and fingers. is a fairly common perseveration for people in these states. And so I figured, well, there's a communication going on between the thumb and the fingers. So I stuck my hand in between his thumb and fingers, and what he was doing changed. So bingo, something's happening, I'm going to follow this. And as he did that, he started rubbing less, but exploring more, and explored my hand, and then up my arm a little bit, and then he backed down, and then up my arm until he got to my upper arm. And I had the intuition that he was maybe wanting deeper contact with his son and wanted a hug. So I went right in and tried hugging him. Well, he pulled back instantly. I was on the right track. It was too soon. So then he starts working my arm again. And after about three or four tries at this, me trying the hug too soon, he finally gets up to my shoulder. And then he discovers my hair. And then he starts stroking my head. And not in a way that was exploratory, but a way it was deeply connecting and intimately touching. And then I went in for the hug, and we hugged. First hug we'd had since I was 12 years old, because, you know, men are in that generation don't hug after, you know, 10 or 12. And it was incredibly deep and meaningful for both of us.
So you took this great belief that, you know, there is somebody home, and he's trying to communicate that this perseveration that's happening, this motion that's happening with his fingers and thumbs, actually there's something meaningful in that, that he's actually someone you can relate to if you actually pay attention to and follow what it is that he's doing that is an effort to communicate.
That he needed support or just something different introduced to have the communication go further.
And so the situation with so many of our elders and people who are facing dementia, Alzheimer's, it's really, there's an assumption that they are kind of lost to us, that they can't communicate, that relationship isn't really possible.
I think it's all too common. And, you know, I would call it a nocebo attitude. And nocebo, if you translate it from the Latin, means to harm. But most people are familiar with the term placebo, which placebo means to please. And if we have an attitude to start with, that nobody's home, or that it's not much use, or maybe they're trying to do something that I can't understand, so I'm just going to do my daily care routine and get out of there as quick as possible. We had one chaplain say to us, well, actually several chaplains say that, you know, I used to go in, say my prayers, do a little scripture reading, and get out of there as quick as possible because it was uncomfortable for me. So 10 minutes max. And now they go in, and they just breathe with the person, sit with the person, notice everything that's coming from the person, every little twitch and movement and turn of the head, and report back and assume that that's, they're trying to communicate something. And now they're happy to spend a half hour to an hour with people.
Now, Stan, I know a little bit just from my own experience with my father and also my grandfather about what it is that we're talking about, these states of dementia, these states of forgetfulness and Alzheimer's. Can you tell us, like, what are the kinds of things that people start to do? People start to lose contact with what we call reality. They're not able to sort of take care of themselves. And what is it that really happens that's so common that you're addressing from this different perspective?
It's complicated, Will, because here's my dad who's slowly losing his memory, and he's living at home. And I went to visit one time, and we were playing cards around, you know, the dining room table like we've done as a family for, you know, forever. And my dad can't quite get the cards straight, or he doesn't get it fast enough like he used to. He used to be like one of the best poker players I've ever seen. And then my mom, bless her heart, starts correcting him, thinking that she's helping, which the intention is right. But he feels criticized, and he actually does worse, just like probably you or I would when we feel criticized, and goes away a little further. And this way he gets a little worse at playing cards. And then she tries to help him some more. So it's an escalating, it's like a double bind. It's like if he tries, he's going to get criticized. If he doesn't try, he'll get criticized more. So what does he do? He withdraws. I tried to talk to my mom about this. My brother tried. She just couldn't get it.
So you're describing a situation where there's, say, a biological condition, which is maybe the aging process causes a certain kind of forgetfulness. And then, in addition to that, there are the relationships and the context that kind of feed into it and then make it worse. So then, but then people are only looking at this biological disease aspect. They're not looking at the way in which the communication or the relationship or the way that people are approaching the person is actually contributing to and making worse. And is that a pretty common dynamic that you see, that there's an overlooking of the context and how it could be playing into what it is that someone's going through, that just the whole thing is blamed on dementia and Alzheimer's?
Almost everybody has the best intentions. Well, gee, Grandma, my boyfriend really didn't steal your rings. You know, mm-hmm. But Grandma thinks that the boyfriend stole her rings. And the granddaughter can tell Grandma 20 or 30 times that, and it doesn't have any effect. And this is what we call, it's a little bit ironic, this is what we call two people have forgetfulness. Because the granddaughter forgets what she has said hasn't worked for the last 20 times. She's not taking the feedback because it's outside her system or her beliefs, or doesn't know how to go beyond what we call the consensus reality, the so-called reality realm. In reality, the boyfriend didn't take Grandma's rings, but at some level, the grandma thinks that this boyfriend is a thief. So then we'd have to look at things in a more symbolic or meaningful way and say, well, what is the boyfriend perhaps stealing from the grandma? Mm-hmm. Often, in case it has to do with relationship, the grandma is jealous because the boyfriend is now taking up the granddaughter's time and attention. But especially people of that older generation can't bring these things out directly.
So if, as a helper, you work out that symbolic meaning of the metaphorical communication that the person is making, that they're talking about the rings being stolen, but really they're talking about jealousy and feeling like they're losing their relationship with someone, how do you then engage with the situation to help it move forward?
Well, one of the ways is to really try to get more direct and to bring it out into the open. My good friend and colleague, Tom Richards, his grandmother, who was 94, in a nursing home, going in and out of memory loss a bit, not so horrible. And his brother, Dick, came to town, and he hadn't seen his grandmother for about 6 years. And there was no way he was going to go visit his grandmother in a nursing home, because I think it just scared him, actually. This is one of the things that's going to happen to many of us, and it's for people that aren't used to it, it's not pleasant. Last day Dick was in town, we took him out for breakfast and then strong-armed him into visiting his grandmother. And so Tom is on one side of the bed, I'm on the other side of the bed, and we're each holding Grandma's hands. Dick is against the far wall, away at the end of the bed, plastered against the wall and not saying anything. And we're having a good conversation with Grandma. And then once in a while, just out of the blue, so to speak, Tom's grandma would look into the air and say, "Sonny, go down and stoke the fire. It's cold in here." And we'd be like, "What the heck?" You know, and it's because these places are usually about 87 degrees, you know. And so after about the 10th time, I'm racking my brain thinking, "Oh, cold." And I said, "Dick, come up here where I am and hold your grandmother's hand." And he did. And that was the end of going down to stoke the fire. We're just trying to get things more. It's just good, basic family system to work well.
You mentioned something very important, Stan, which is that people are slightly angry, a little bit agitated, a little bit difficult to deal with, and then there's this huge reaction in wherever they're living, the nursing home or wherever it is. And I think this is really common, that so many of our elders, people who are forgetful or facing dementia or Alzheimer's, get into a place where they are responded to with their anger or their assertiveness or their just unruliness or difficult to be with. I know my dad would sometimes just get surly and mean and angry at that, just verbally at the people working with him. And that's when people get medicated. That's when people get the antipsychotic medications. And we're seeing a huge number of people who are, even without any kind of diagnosis of schizophrenia or bipolar, but just to control their agitation. And I think we do need to acknowledge that, well, there's a reason why these medications are being used, because they do tranquilize people. What's your sense of that? Because, I mean, so many of us are just concerned about that. That's not a good approach to keep people under control and keep their agitation under control by giving them dangerous antipsychotics, which often do shorten their lifespans and cause terrible side effects as well.
Absolutely. I there's been a lot of great research done on this, especially in the UK, shorten their lifespans and somehow, sometimes just very quickly kill them. I'll be blunt. The research shows that. And of course, there's never been any testing done on elders because it's unethical. I mean, really. So the dosages are, by guess and by golly, usually they can only take maximum a half of a dose of what a normal, young, healthy adult could take. There's a fantastic study done in a Canadian nursing home in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and they realized that they were using too many psychotropic drugs, and everybody knows this, but what do you do about it? What are the alternatives? And so they hired a nurse full-time to do drug review, and this is a unit with about 280 beds, and there was 56% of the people were on some dosage of psychotropic medicine. And over a three-year period, she was able to reduce that to 6%. And people were happier. The staff had an easier time caring for people because they were more alert, more functional, could do more on their own. And I think it's tragic. And I also commiserate with caregivers because they don't know what else to do.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio, and our guest today is Stan Tamandel. Stan is a therapist and teacher who has more than 25 years' experience working with elders around forgetfulness, dementia, and extremely withdrawn states. That's an incredible thing that nurse was able to do, to be able to reduce the use of psychotropic medications from 56% to 3% in that nursing home. How did she do that? How was she able to get the medications reduced without still having the original problems of people being agitated or difficult to deal with or having behavioral problems?
Well, the main thing she did was just very simple. She just did drug reviews on everybody, then just went, and tackled it, about six people at a time. And then saying, well, this person was given this medication 3 years ago for this condition, for this agitation. Has that recurred? And staff would say, no. Then she'd say, well, let's cut it by half and see what happens. Still no recurrence. Let's cut it out entirely and see what happens. But this is just no rocket science, no psychotherapy involved here, just by reviewing drugs and reducing medications and then going by feedback, I guess I'd put it again.
Stan, tell us about the whole dying process, because of course what's happening when we become older is that we're preparing for the end of our lives. And I know that this is a very significant part of the work that you do. And I'm also especially interested in the way in which these creative and also spiritual states can emerge as part of people's preparation and then passing.
We had a friend here in town that died recently, and he died of HIV/AIDS. He had AIDS, and he wanted no medications, no morphine, no painkillers, because he wanted to stay aware as he died. Then he went into altered states, and some of them nearly extreme, but the family was able to handle it. The family was in total agreement, and the well-meaning people at hospice, of course, wanted to give him morphine, or Dilaudid, or, some opiate. And he said no, and he died an incredibly aware, sometimes very far out in altered states death, but he would come and go from these states, connect with his family, totally supported and loved. And after he died, the half a dozen or so caregivers that had come to his home, he died in his home, told the family that they were amazed, and that it was the first unmedicated death they had ever witnessed.
Stan, I think so many of us want to really support our parents as they become older and really help them in the best way that we can. And at the same time, many of us have histories of abuse maybe, or their family secrets, or maybe we've been treated very, very badly by our parents. Do you see these processes playing out as people get older? Are there ways in which maybe some of that can get addressed and maybe even resolved, even if someone is starting to go into states where they're having being forgetful or beginnings of Alzheimer's states? I mean, what kinds of ideas would you have for helping people who want to relate to their parents more as they get older, but at the same time, there is this history of abuse that maybe has never been addressed.
I don't mean to belittle it, but we work with it like we do with other abuse issues, and that is for the family member or members, and for the person that's losing their memory, the so-called identified patient. We work with it with slowness and care and extreme awareness. Which position is the person in the moment? That is, are they more feeling more like the victim? Are they feeling more like a protector? Or are they feeling more like an abuser? And I think this is the root, unfortunately, of a lot of elder abuse. And people are even unconscious about it. I'll just be honest. They start, you know, sniping away at the elder's bank account. They've got a joint account. Or they'll just start putting them down. And a lot of it's very unconscious. Just it's that whole, just a negative atmosphere in the house. Or they'll just start even insulting them, telling them that they're crazy and that they unuseful things. And that, like I say, a lot of it's not aware, they're not aware of, and some of it they are aware of, but they're stuck in it, abusing their elder who abused them as a kid. And I think if you can bring some gentle awareness to that, that really, really helps.
What do you think of the whole question of choosing to die? The idea that in Oregon, there's a physician-assisted end-of-life process. People end their lives, suicide, assisted suicide. And that choice that people are sometimes want to make. And this has been very controversial in the disability rights community because of the concern that, well, if you have a society that says people are expendable and they're no longer productive and, you know, it doesn't mean anything to just be, you know, being in a nursing home, then of course you're going to start killing people or sanctioning or allowing them to be killed. And what are your thoughts about that?
It's very tricky because, for instance, in every state that I know of, if someone is in a nursing home and they're fading and you put a spoon up to their mouth with food on it and they open their mouth, you have to feed them. That's the law, because otherwise you are going to be starving them. And I have seen a lot of overweight people. I have seen a lot of people in horrible situations where they might have wished they were dead. I don't know for sure. But they're being fed. Some people, and actually most people, die by stopping eating and drinking. And it's actually a relatively good way to die because when you do that, the endorphins kick in your brain and the pain isn't there, the thirst isn't there, the pain of hunger isn't there, and you go on amazing inner journeys. This is why people in the desert, as they were dying of thirst, would see mirages. Your mind is producing, you know, hopefully what you need to see in those moments. And it usually takes about 10 or 15 days to die. And there are some people that consciously choose that. But most people, when they are dying of thirst and starvation, have long passed the point of choice. And it goes into the deeper issue of our society. There's this point where instead of keeping people alive, we're not allowing them to die. And we do have like incredible medications and medical care now. And we're seeing in nursing homes where a large percent of the population in the nursing home, certainly in my parents' generation, would have passed away from pneumonia, pulmonary disease, or heart disease. And they're being kept alive. And is it right? Is it not right? And then people that want to make that choice can do it in a lot of different ways. We don't have to move to Oregon or Washington. We had a 95-year-old friend of ours in down east who was on heart medication, and then she was an artist, but she was losing her vision, and she just gathered all her family around and said, on this date, I'm going to stop taking my heart medication, so please be with me. So after she stopped taking her heart medication, the family stayed with her about 2 weeks until she passed away.
And what if that decision is part of being depressed or despair or an inner conflict, and maybe it's not the right decision, though?
That's where I think psychotherapists can come in and help, and family therapists, and help the person and the family work with the depression, work with the conflict, and get as clear as possible. Just giving somebody an antidepressant and telling them that they've got to live another 10 years, it's probably going to make them more depressed. I don't know. Well, that certainly would me. In that state of, I'd almost call it a zombie state. Excuse the word, but it's that in between. I'm depressed enough I can't get out of it. I've got some medication that's helping me kind of stay relatively level, but I'm not really enjoying my life. I don't like my life even anymore. So what are they depressed about? What's behind it? What's going on? And I think this is where abuse issues can come up from the past or present. So I'm all for choice, and I'm all for working with people's deep emotional states, spiritual states, and their relationships.
And what words of advice might you have for family members, for caretakers, for people who are maybe facing burnout? Because it can be so overwhelming when a parent or relative is at that place of forgetfulness and dementia and end of life. And it can be really a recipe for just getting exhausted and burning out. What sort of words of advice would you have for them?
Start getting relief early. Like I said, my mom's experience was she kept my dad at home, you know, for 2 years too long, and it almost did her in. There is at least some good daycare programs around, there are respite programs around, and the people that have to go into them, some of them enjoy them, some of them kick and scream going into them, but it's just necessary to have for the caregivers to do it. If the caregiver doesn't take care of themselves, there's no care. So really, really doing that early, early on. And then really, this is where talking with other family members, friends about, well, when do I put Dad into a nursing home? What do you think? You know, how do you think I'm doing? And family members can be relatively direct with, you know, the main caregiver. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. There's just, you know, some caregivers just have to do it to the burnt out end. I've seen that too often, but there's just no dissuading them. They love the person like crazy, and their life is for their life. So it's very touching and hard to deal with. So,
Stan, we are just about out of time for the interview. Give us some contact information, people who want to find out more about your work and how they can reach you, and also remind us again about the books that you've written and the work that you and your wife and Jacob are doing.
There's one book called Coma Work and Palliative Care, which is really about end stages of life. And then there's another book called An Alzheimer's Surprise Party, New Communication Skills and Insights for Understanding and Relating to People with Dementia. And that's about my father's later stages of going through the whole forgetfulness and Alzheimer's process. Another book is same title, An Alzheimer's Surprise Party, but it says prequel. And both of these are available, all three of them are available, actually, at the Process Work Institute of Portland, or you can Google them online and find them online. And please email us, and that's at annstan, A-N-N-S-T-A-N, at Coma Communication, at C-O-M-A, and then communication, all run together as one word, so annstan at comacommunication.com. Also, we have a website, www.comacommunication.com. It needs web gardening, but the basic information on there has been very useful for people over the years.
Stan Tomondel, thank you so much for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Well, it's been a real pleasure.
You've been listening to an interview with Stan Tomondel. Stan is a therapist and teacher who for the past 25 years has been working with elders on issues of forgetfulness, dementia, and extremely withdrawn states. He's the author of three books on coma and Alzheimer's and works with his wife, Ann Jacob, as a consultant and teacher in Victoria, BC, as well as internationally via phone and Skype. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in.
You've been listening to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, co-sponsored by the Icarus Project, Portland Hearing Voices, and Freedom Center. Madness Radio is hosted by Will Hall, and producer is Leah Harris. Madness Radio is based at KBOO in Oregon and can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network. Listen on the internet at madnessradio.net and on iTunes. Contact us at radio@madnessradio.net.
You are tuned to KBOO in Portland, 90.7 FM.
July 1st, 2013. Station Navigator Report. Thank you, listeners. We had an overwhelming response to the recent program survey. 1,130 people submitted responses to the question, "Do you want to hear Tom Hartman on KABU?" 764 people responded yes. That's 67%. 366 people responded no. That's 32%. There were 1,127 responses to the question, "Are you a KABU member?" 640 people responded yes, 57%. 487 people responded no, 43%. There were responses to the survey left via phone messages, called in by listeners, emails, and given verbally at the station. These responses, split pretty evenly for and against the Hartman Show, were not included in the online results. However, next time we will have a secure way for listeners and members to respond who do not have access to a computer. This was just an information gathering survey, the results of which are now being turned over to the Programming Committee for discussion. The next meeting of the Program Committee will be Tuesday, July 9th at 6 p.m. at KABU. Thanks again for your thoughtful comments, suggestions, and remarks associated with the survey and what you think should be aired on KABU. This has been Lynn Fitch.
With your KBOO noon news headlines, I'm Jimmy Tardy. General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, head of Egypt's armed forces, has issued a 48-hour ultimatum to Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi, insisting that the presidency meet, quote, the demands of the people. El-Sisi has stated that the military stands ready to intervene in Egypt's political process if Morsi fails to acknowledge and work with the huge protests that began on Sunday. With military helicopters flying over the assembled crowds at Cairo's Tahrir Square, the crowds cheered and applauded when they heard the announcement. While many think that the involvement of the Egyptian military in the political crisis is a welcome possibility, some fear that it will lead to an open-ended rule by a junta that most recently ruled Egypt in the 18-month period between the abdication of Hosni Mubarak and the election of Morsi, Egypt's first democratically elected president. Protesters in Hong Kong, marching on the anniversary of the handover of Hong Kong from Great Britain to Chinese control 16 years ago, are making stronger demands than in the past and are turning out in larger numbers. Marchers chanted slogans and held signs demanding that the Beijing